Welcome. So, synthesis of yoga, introduction, chapter 2, the three steps of nature. We recognize then, in the past developments of yoga, a specializing and separative tendency which, like all things in nature, had its justifying and even imperative utility. And we seek a synthesis of the specialized aims and methods which have, in consequence, come into being. So one unitive experience, branching out into various schools, you might say, and what we're trying to do is, again, arrive at a synthesis, and we discussed what the nature of that term, synthesis, means last time. But in order that we may be wisely guided in our effort, we must know first the general principle and purpose underlying this separative impulse, and next, the particular utilities upon which the method of each school of yoga is founded. What does each yoga accomplish uniquely? How was the original integrity of the unitive experience of yoga broken into so many disparate paths? How can we bring them essentially back into a working order where they each support the other? For the general principle, we must interrogate the universal workings of nature herself, recognizing in her no merely specious and elusive activity of a distorting Maya, but the cosmic energy and working of God Himself in His universal being, formulating and inspired by a vast and infinite and yet a minutely selective wisdom, Prajna Prasrita Purani of the Upanishad. So, the implication is that every aspect of nature, each order, each fold in the material of nature can offer a different avenue, a different method, a different approach, a different perspective towards the one essential reality of existence. All of them lead to something real. And none of them is elusive. A distorting Maya. Sri Aurobindo brings this in here almost from the beginning. Remember what he was writing at the same time in The Life Divine, in the series in the Arya, at this point, materialist denial. But to the Vedic consciousness, Maya was not an elusive agency. Maya was the creative, conceptive intelligence of the divine reality, which could encapsulate the infinite in a finite form through the use of its force. It was a real condensation of the being of the divine, not at all illusory. So what manifests is real in the Vedic mind. In the original Vedanta, also, Maya has a positive connotation. It's only 1,000 years after the Upanishads are formulated that we begin to get this sense that Maya is a cheat, a deceiver. That thing, that entity, that conscious agency which wants to deceive us into believing that there is this there when actually that is there. So this working of nature is a positive. It's a manifestation of divine nature. How divine? It is the cosmic energy of the divine being itself. Here it's figured as a he. We've seen dozen years afterwards, Sri Aurobindo was writing about the Supreme as she, as the mother. Whether you apply this or that, you're still speaking about that one true existence. The cosmic energy, this is Shakti, working from God himself, from Shiva. Shiva and Shakti are not different. It's one reality, one poise, supportive, sovereignly gazing upon with an affirmative vision, the other executing the will. So there is no distinction between Shiva and Shakti in the most grand unitive experience. Two, this phrase that he writes here from the Upanishad, if you've gone back and looked at your older copies, you'll see that when Sri Aurobindo first published this in the Arya, he credited this passage to the Gita. But it doesn't come from the Gita. It comes from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, the 4th chapter, the 18th verse, where it says in full, Prajna cha tasmat prasrita purani. From him has proceeded the ancient wisdom. So, we have to look at the various methods of yoga, the many different sadhanas, the spiritual paths that take you to this experience which lifts you out of your divided self and into the experience of that one. Yoga is that which unites. It is a path that yokes you to that. It's not simply the unit of experience. It is also the thing that takes you there. And it's as if you're harnessing all the conscious powers of the being necessary to achieve it. But you can achieve contact, communion, immersion into that soul reality through the various aspects of your nature, of your personal being. So he will describe all of those elements now, the three steps of nature. Afterwards, he writes, we may more easily find the one common principle and the one common power from which all derive their being and tendency, towards which all subconsciously move, and in which, therefore, it is possible for all consciously to unite. One goal of the synthesis. The progressive self-manifestation of nature in man, termed in modern language his evolution, must necessarily depend upon three successive elements. So, evolution, let's talk about that for a moment. The term comes from the Latin evolvere, to roll from. So, to unroll, to disclose. It's not a movement from nothing to nothing, or from nothing to something, or from something to nothing. It is not a movement from one reality to a different reality. All realities are contained in the one. So, everything must already be present for it to evolve. So, if life emerges as a power in matter, it must already be there to evolve from it, because it's unrolling itself. Nature is unrolling life out of matter. If mind manifests, it must similarly be an unrolling of a potential which is already present in nature. And if these are powers of energy and consciousness, then energy and consciousness must belong to nature. Nature cannot be absent them. There is that which is already evolved. There is that which, still imperfect, still partly fluid, is persistently in the stage of conscious evolution. And there is that which is to be evolved, and may perhaps be already displayed, if not constantly, then occasionally or with some regularity of recurrence in primary formations or in others more developed, and it may well be, even in some, however rare, that are near to the highest possible realization of our present humanity. So here he arcs from the material up to the top, hinting at what may come in the future, but is fleetingly present even now. The highest possible realization of our present humanity. So this, again, would be a peak of the mental range, because the human has not manifested that which is divine in origin yet. What has evolved in the human is the mental consciousness, straining to reach that infinite. So what is the highest possible realization of mind? That is what is currently accessible to humanity. For the march of nature is not drilled to a regular and mechanical forward stepping. She reaches constantly beyond herself, even at the cost of subsequent deplorable retreats. She has rushes. She has splendid and mighty outbursts. She has immense realizations. She storms sometimes passionately forward, hoping to take the kingdom of heaven by violence. And these self-exceedings are the revelation of that in her which is most divine or else most diabolical, but in either case the most puissant, powerful, to bring her rapidly forward towards her goal. That which nature has evolved for us and has firmly founded is the bodily life. She has effected a certain combination and harmony of the two inferior but most fundamentally necessary elements of our action and progress upon earth. Matter, which, however the two ethereally spiritual may despise it, is our foundation and the first condition of all our energies and realizations, and the life energy, which is our means of existence in a material body and the basis there, even of our mental and spiritual activities. So, matter and life. Anam, in the old Taittiriya Upanishad's usage, food is the body, and life is prana. Or you can say, going back to the Veda, the earth principle, prithvi, the life principle, vayu. But still, these are recognitions of an order of reality. At the base is the body. Powering the body and arriving at an equilibrium is the life force. So, life and matter have reached a kind of working relationship where we have that as our foundation upon which to build. She has successfully achieved a certain stability of her constant material movement, which is at once sufficiently steady and durable and sufficiently pliable and mutable to provide a fit dwelling place and instrument for the progressively manifesting God in humanity. So there is embedded in us a Godhead which wants to evolve, which wants to work itself out and, in a sense, play in nature. This is what is meant by the fable in the Aitareya Upanishad, which tells us that the gods rejected the animal forms successfully offered to them by the divine self and only when man was produced cried out, "This indeed is perfectly made," and consented to enter in. Now that's the Aitareya Upanishad, first section, first chapter, section 2, the third verse. And it says, Purusho Vava Sukratam. This man is perfectly made. They had rejected the gods' earlier forms, the cow, etc., because they couldn't hold the power which this descending mind force would bring. Only when the human was there could all the complement of the godheads from above find situations, and then they agree to come. One invades and occupies this space in the human, another agrees to occupy that. And so this sort of is a continuation of the Vedic idea that this commerce that is enjoined upon humanity through the sacrifice invites the circulation of divine powers through us. The Godheads get born in us from above at our invitation. But we have to be ready. We have to be capable of holding that power, because they watch from above and they agree to descend only when they see that the habitation can indeed hold that force, because the being will be surcharged with light and power unusual to it. Back to Sri Aurobindo here. She, nature, she has effected also a working compromise between the inertia of matter and the active life that lives in and feeds on it, by which not only is vital existence sustained, but the fullest developments of mentality are rendered possible. This equilibrium constitutes the basic status of nature in man and is termed in the language of yoga his gross body, composed of the material or food sheath and the nervous system or vital vehicle. He has a note here, anakosha and pranakosha. Ana, as we've said, is the food sheath, anakosha and pranakosha. Now this, we often think, occurs in as a term, kosha, in the Taittiriya Upanishad, because that is the Bliss Upanishad, where all the various orders of being are discussed. But actually, the word does not occur there. Sharira is the preferred term there. But the idea of a kosha, which is from the Rig Veda and the Atharva Veda, a cask, a pail, a bucket, and later, as a sheath, the five different bodies are seen as sort of onion skins covering the reality of the soul. But the idea is that the kosha carries the force of prana, the intelligence of mind within it. You find this really coming into being in the Pangala Upanishad. And you can find that there in the second chapter in the fifth verse, where they're discussing the five sheaths and the subtle body. Also, gross body could be called the stula sharira, or the stula deha. And what that connotes is that both body and life are combined, are working together. If then this inferior equilibrium is the basis and first means of the higher movements which the universal power contemplates, and if it constitutes the vehicle in which the divine here seeks to reveal itself, if the Indian saying is true, that the body is the instrument provided for the fulfillment of the right law of our nature, then any final recoil from the physical life must be a turning away from the completeness of the divine wisdom and a renunciation of its aim in earthly manifestation. Such a refusal may be, owing to some secret law of their development, the right attitude for certain individuals, but never the aim intended for mankind. Because the yoga is meant to occupy all of the manifestation of the divine, which includes the body, the life, and the mind. So everything must be part of a larger plan of yoga. Regardless of whether the sannyasin aiming for drastic release has justice in his individual effort, it can't be part of that which would become a cosmic yoga. The aim of the cosmos is not to retire back into the absolute from which it manifested, but to fulfill itself through the aeonic evolution of which our conscious growth is part of the scene. He writes, it can be, therefore, no integral yoga which ignores the body or makes its annulment or its rejection indispensable to a perfect spirituality. Rather, the perfecting of the body also should be the last triumph of the spirit, and to make the bodily life also divine must be God's final seal upon his work in the universe. And he, Sri Aurobindo, was personally working on this even as he wrote these lines. We find that, of course, in his record of yoga, which he kept privately for years together. The obstacle which the physical presents to the spiritual is no argument for the rejection of the physical. From the unseen providence of things, our greatest difficulties are our best opportunities. A supreme difficulty is nature's indication to us of a supreme conquest to be won and an ultimate problem to be solved. It is not a warning of an inextricable snare to be shunned or of an enemy too strong for us from whom we must flee. So the impossible is only that which hasn't been done yet. Equally, the vital and nervous energies in us are there for a great utility. They too demand the divine realization of their possibilities and our ultimate fulfillment. So, if the inclusion of the physical is part of yoga, then also the inclusion and perfection of the life force in us is part as well. The great part assigned to this element in the universal scheme is powerfully emphasized by the Catholic wisdom of the Upanishads. As the spokes of a wheel in its nave, so in the life energy is all established. The triple knowledge and the sacrifice and the power of the strong and the purity of the wise. Under the control of the life energy is all this that is established in the triple heaven. This from the Prashna Upanishad. Prashna means question. It is, therefore, no integral yoga that kills these vital energies, forces them into a nerveless quiescence, or roots them out as the source of noxious activities. Their purification, not their destruction, their transformation, control, and utilization is the aim in view with which they have been created and developed in us. So it is not the annihilation of the body, the renunciation of life that is required of us, but turning to them and bringing them into the larger purview of what is perfectible. And this, of course, is part of the work of the tantric synthesis and certainly of Hatha Yoga, the forceful yoga. If the bodily life is what nature has firmly evolved for us as her base and first instrument, it is our mental life that she is evolving as her immediate next aim and superior instrument. This and her ordinary exaltations is the lofty, preoccupying thought in her. This, except in her periods of exhaustion and recoil into a reposeful and recuperating obscurity, is her constant pursuit wherever she can get free from the trammels of her first vital and physical realizations. A trammel is a net or a shackle. For here in man, we have a distinction which is of the utmost importance. He has in him not a single mentality, but a double and a triple, the mind material and nervous, the pure intellectual mind which liberates itself from the illusions of the body and the senses, and a divine mind above intellect, which in its turn liberates itself from the imperfect modes of the logically discriminative and imaginative reason. So it becomes more complex, of course, in later years, and you've read it in The Life Divine, and read it probably in his letters on yoga. But mind as a plane in its manifestation in the other planes of life and matter is conditioned by those vehicles in which it sits. And also it is conditioned by the descent of a higher light from above into it. So it can be conditioned, and it certainly is conditioned by and dulled by the obscurity of the body and the passions of the vitality, but is illuminated and uplifted by the descent of a higher consciousness as it moves into it. Mind in man is first enmeshed in the life of the body, where in the plant it is entirely involved and in animals always imprisoned. It accepts this life as not only the first, but the whole condition of its activities, and serves its needs as if they were the entire aim of existence. But the bodily life in man is a base, not the aim, his first condition and not his last determinant. In the just idea of the ancients, man is essentially the thinker, the manu, the mental being, who leads the life and the body. Manomaya Prana Sharira Neta, from the Mundaka Upanishad 2.2.8. Not the animal who is led by them. The true human existence, therefore, only begins when the intellectual mentality emerges out of the material and we begin more and more to live in the mind, independent of the nervous and physical obsession, and in the measure of that liberty, are able to accept rightly and rightly to use the life of the body. For freedom, and not a skillful subjection, is the true means of mastery. A free, not a compulsory acceptance of the conditions, the enlarged and sublimated conditions of our physical being, is the high human ideal. But beyond this intellectual mentality is the divine. So he goes on to describe what lies beyond, of course. But at this point, there is the glad note that there is an existence beyond the intellectual mentality that we're struggling to achieve, which calls us to greater heights, greater luminosities, a greater perfection. But back to the mind. The mental life, thus evolving in man, is not indeed a common possession. So he's not of the opinion that simply because humanity possesses the mind, that it really lives primarily from the mind. It will become clear that humanity is generally posited in the vital range of existence, using the mind to rationalize the acquisition of its desired objects, not leading first a light of philosophic excellence applied to life and body, but something quite other. Well, philosophic excellence, I can tell you, has its own limitations. In actual appearance, he says, it would seem as if it were only developed to the fullest in individuals, and as if there were great numbers and even the majority in whom it is either a small and ill-organized part of their normal nature or not evolved at all or latent and not easily made active. Certainly, the mental life is not a finished evolution of nature. It is not yet firmly founded in the human animal. The sign is that the fine and full equilibrium of vitality and matter, the sane, robust, long-lived human body, is ordinarily found only in races or classes of men who reject the effort of thought, its disturbances, its tensions, or think only with the material mind. Civilized man has yet to establish an equilibrium between the fully active mind and the body. He does not normally possess it. Indeed, the increasing effort towards a more intense mental life seems to create, frequently, an increasing disequilibrium of the human elements, so that it is possible for eminent scientists to describe genius as a form of insanity, a result of degeneration, a pathological morbidity of nature. The phenomena which are used to justify this exaggeration, when taken not separately but in connection with all other relevant data, point to a different truth. Genius is one attempt of the universal energy to so quicken and intensify our intellectual powers that they shall be prepared for those more puissant, direct, and rapid faculties which constitute the play of the supra-intellectual or divine mind. It is not then a freak, an inexplicable phenomenon, but a perfectly natural next step in the right line of her evolution. She has harmonized the bodily life with the material mind. She is harmonizing it with the play of the intellectual mentality. For that, although it tends to a depression of the full animal and vital vigor, need not produce active disturbances. Now he's treating this in terms of an evolutionary advance from one level to the other, but of course, in The Life Divine, and again in Letters on Yoga, he later introduces the psyche as the leader of the nature, who harmonizes and brings into full disclosure the various elements of inner possibility. We leave that aside here. And as she is shooting yet beyond in the attempt to reach a still higher level. Nor are the disturbances created by her process as great as is often represented. Some of them are the crude beginnings of new manifestations. Others are an easily corrected movement of disintegration, often fruitful of fresh activities, and always a small price to pay for the far-reaching results that she has in view. We may perhaps, if we consider all the circumstances, come to this conclusion that mental life, far from being a recent appearance in man, is the swift repetition in him of a previous achievement from which the energy in the race had undergone one of her deplorable recoils. The savage is perhaps not so much the first forefather of civilized man as the degenerate descendant of a previous civilization. For if the actuality of intellectual achievement is unevenly distributed, the capacity is spread everywhere. So again, this takes the old theme of the golden age of the past, and where we are now is fallen from the truth of those earlier times. And he's writing throughout the rest of this paragraph in a sort of mocking sense, a sort of ironic tone. So do bear that in mind. For if the actuality of intellectual achievement is unevenly distributed, the capacity is spread everywhere. It has been seen that in individual cases, even the racial type considered by us the lowest, the Negro fresh from the perennial barbarism of Central Africa, is capable, without admixture of blood, without waiting for future generations, of the intellectual culture, if not yet of the intellectual accomplishment of the dominant European. Now, this is his skillful way of presenting an argument against racism while using the terms that racists will be familiar with. So, again, be a little subtle in your reading of it. Even in the mass, men seem to need, in favorable circumstances, only a few generations to cover ground that ought apparently to be measured in the terms of millenniums. Either, then, man, by his privilege as a mental being, is exempt from the full burden of the tardy laws of evolution, or else he already represents, and with helpful conditions and in the right stimulating atmosphere, can always display a high level of material capacity for the activities of the intellectual life. It is not mental incapacity, but the long rejection or seclusion from opportunity and withdrawal of the awakening impulse that creates the savage. Barbarism is an intermediate sleep, not an original darkness. So he has actually argued against this perspective that there are gradations of humanity. Give somebody a body with a brain and a soul, and they can become whatever anybody can become, is his position. And he's held that position from the time that he was a student in England. When he came back to India, pronounced it again, and believed it to the last. The long rejection or seclusion from opportunity can create the dull and the torpid, and that is wrong. And to Sri Aurobindo, all of society should be capable of living a simple but rich existence, that the social order should offer us the fullness of what the psychological wealth is that comes with a full understanding and embrace of nature. It isn't that you have to pile up goods on the gross physical plane to be successful in life. But what is your inner probity? What can you reach in the inner dimensions? Those are the treasures. Those are the pearls without price. So barbarism is an intermediate sleep, not an original darkness. And by the way, the idea savage is a word that is really taken from the Latin, silvaticus, pertaining to the woods, the people who live in the woods. Just as those who consider themselves to be civilized call those folks out there heathens because they live in the heath. They're people who live in nature. Sri Aurobindo fully embraces and unites himself with those. The savage, which means to common usage in English, the wild, the uncivilized, the uncultured, sounds better and better. Except that we want to grow through the mind and beyond it. We want to keep those vital aspects of the material existence, but reach soul depth and reach suprarational levels and bring all into harmony. There is a great hymn that we'll bring in at some point, perhaps, from the Atharva Veda, which you can go to our website and listen to Vasanti Rao sing. Om Dyauh Shantihi, it's that one that begins. And it brings into view that the divine is that heaven. It is that mid-world, the vital plane. It is earth. It's the herbs on the earth. It's the lordly trees. It's the water. It's all the gods of the cosmos. It's the Brahman from which all manifest. All reachable in peace. What is interesting in the hymn is that there's no mention of the human life. It describes this world, this grand world, this nature that we greet and meet as being full of peace at every level. And what the human viewing it wants is to feel that peace from the divine, that peace from the realm of the gods, that peace in the breadth of the mind, in the vastness of the heart, in all the materiality around, reaching down into the roots of the earth. Peace, peace, only peace. May that very peace come to me. Go listen to her sing it. So I think we're going to stop there for the night. We're moving at roughly the same pace that we did in The Life Divine. And we'll gather again and finish this chapter on the three steps of nature next time. This is a section from Savitri, Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. This is on page 35. That is not correct. We begin on page 34. Only a while at first, these heavenlier states, these large, wide, poised upliftings could endure. The high and luminous tension breaks too soon. The body's stone stillness and the life's hushed trance, the breathless might and calm of silent mind. Or slowly they fail as sets a golden day. The restless nether members tire of peace. A nostalgia of old little works and joys. A need to call back small familiar selves, to tread the accustomed and inferior way. The need to rest in a natural pose of fall, as a child who learns to walk can walk not long. Replace the tightened will forever to climb on the heart's altar, dim the sacred fire. An old pull of subconscious cords renews. It draws the unwilling spirit from the heights, or a dull gravitation drags us down to the blind-driven inertia of our base. This, too, the supreme diplomat can use. He makes our fall a means for greater rise. For into ignorant nature's gusty field, into the half-ordered chaos of mortal life, the formless power, the self of eternal light, follow in the shadow of the spirit's descent. The twin duality forever one. chooses its home mid the tumults of the sense. He comes unseen into our darker parts, and curtained by the darkness, does his work, a subtle and all-knowing guest and guide, till they too feel the need and will to change. All here must learn to obey a higher law. Our body's cells must hold the immortal's flame. Else would the spirit reach alone its source, leaving a half-saved world to its dubious fate. Nature would ever labor unredeemed. Our earth would ever spin unhelped in space. And this immense creation's purpose fail, till at last the frustrate universe sank undone. Even his godlike strength to rise must fall. His greater consciousness withdrew behind. Dim and eclipsed, his human outside strove to feel again the old sublimities, bring the high saving touch, the ethereal flame, call back to its dire need the divine force. Always the power poured back like sudden rain, or slowly in his breast a presence grew. It clambered back to some remembered height, or soared above the peak from which it fell. Each time he rose, there was a larger poise, a dwelling on a higher spirit plane. The light remained in him a longer space. In this oscillation between earth and heaven, in this ineffable communion's climb, there grew in him, as grows a waxing moon, the glory of the integer of his soul. A union of the real with the unique, a gaze of the alone from every face, the presence of the eternal in the hours, widening the mortal mind's half-look on things, bridging the gap between man's force and fate, made whole the fragment being we are here. At last was one a firm spiritual poise, a constant lodging in the eternal's realm, a safety in the silence and the ray, a settlement in the immutable. His heights of being lived in the still self. His mind could rest on a supernal ground and look down on the magic and the play where the godchild lies on the lap of night and dawn and the everlasting puts on time's disguise. Light and love to you all. Namaste. Jai Ma.